Hello and welcome to Speak Spin Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm your host, Nancy Tatro, and we'll be spending the next hour together here on Speak Spin Radio, which is a show all about communication, because I believe the quality of our communication has a direct impact on the quality of our lives. Every week, I speak to experts from the worlds of business, media, academia, human relations, and the arts, so we can all learn how to communicate better. And this portion of the show is sponsored by Compass Strategies. Compass Strategies is an online marketing company with the single-minded goal of guiding business owners and nonprofit organizations to online marketing success. Compass Strategies offers website design, search engine optimization, email marketing, and social media marketing services that will turn your website into a 24/7 revenue-generating machine. I urge you to contact Compass Strategies today at 916-934-0365. That's 916-934-0365. Or go to their website at www.compassstrategies.net. That's Compass, C-O-M-P-A-S-S, hyphen strategies.net. And now this week, it's my pleasure to welcome my guest, Sandra Mardenfeld. Sandra is an assistant professor and the director of the journalism program at Long Island University's CW Post Campus. A freelance editor and writer for many years, Sandra has contributed to more than 50 newspapers, magazines, and websites. Her features, articles, essays, and reviews have appeared in such publications as Car and Travel, Allure, The New York Times Book Review, Parents and Children, The Daily News, Elegant Bride, Working Woman, Time Out New York, Stage Bill, and The Christian Science Monitor, to name just a few. And she was the managing editor for Playgirl and Fashion Almanac magazines, as well as the Broadway editor of Playville. So, Sandra, welcome to Speak Spin Radio.
Thank you, Nancy. It's nice to be here.
Thanks for coming into the station to talk to us today. One thing I didn't mention about your background, Sandra, is that you're completing your doctorate at Rutgers University this spring semester, so congratulations.
That's right. I defend on May 21st.
Ah, well, good luck. That's great. And this is important, actually, to mention as it relates to our conversation today, because it's going to be based on your research on reporters' privilege and shield laws. At first, I'd love it if you could tell us a bit about how you got started in journalism. And looking at the stuff that you've written or edited so many different types of publications. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I was reading through the list, I couldn't help but notice that, you know, there's Playgirl and the Christian Science Monitor, both in the same paragraph.
That's kind of interesting.
Yeah. You've written for a lot of different things. So how did you get started?
You know, it was one of those things. I always enjoyed writing. I think from like fifth grade on, I was like the creative writing kid, doing the library programs, working on the yearbook, working on the school newspaper. Mm-hmm. And really, I was one of the few of my friends who really knew what they wanted to do. Mm. And so I went to college and I majored in journalism and interned on publications. I interned at Isaac Asimov's Science Fiction Magazine. Ah. I interned at Working Woman and just really loved it. Mm-hmm. And so I came out ready to start my career. And of course, it was a media crisis where ad revenue was down and there were no jobs. Mm-hmm. And I spent the first year post-college working at a yogurt shop. To this day, I still spin yogurt beautifully.
It's a good skill.
It's a good skill. But I sent out resumes after resumes, and it's something I can really commiserate with my students. Mm-hmm. I always tell them it's a numbers game. Mm-hmm. I remember I stopped counting how many resumes I sent out at like 320.
Yeah.
And then I got my first job, which was in Manhasset Publishing Group for a bunch of computer magazines. Mm-hmm. And that was my first gig as like an editorial assistant. Mm-hmm. And then I applied through New York Times Help Wanted Classifieds, which really nobody does anymore.
Back
these
in the
days.
Day. Right. That was the
and,
thing to do.
And got the Playbill gig.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right. And how long were you with Playbill?
I was at Playbill for about 6 years. Mm-hmm. And I think Playbill really helped me develop my freelancing career because theater is very cyclical.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, during the winter season, during the spring season, up until Tony's, we were always swamped.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was dead.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we still had to go to work. We still had to maintain the shows that we were working on.
Right.
But the workload really kind of was less in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
So I had more opportunities to freelance.
I see.
And it really developed that end.
Okay. Okay, great. So I know, as I said, all these different publications that you've written for and all these different things that you've done, you started teaching a number of years ago, right? That
I did. I started teaching after Playgirl. Because okay. I always say you can only work about a year in porn if you're sane. And
I can understand that.
I was trying to decide what I wanted to do. And I had actually all these job offers. It was the only time in my life where, like, everything was clicking. People were calling, offering me jobs, offering me more money, which has never happened again.
Mm.
And what I really wanted to do is I got this adjunct position.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I really want to teach this one class in freelance and see what it's like to freelance full time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did that for a while. But as I adjuncted, I realized I really love teaching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I kind of veered more in that direction.
Right. Right. Now, and what are you teaching at LIU now? I know you're the director of the journalism program, but you're teaching too, right?
So. Right. At LIU Post, I'm the director of the journalism program, so I do things like we have a yearly high school awards best of journalism contest.
Mm-hmm.
So I help organize that. I set up some affiliations.
Mm-hmm.
We recently embedded Patch into our coursework. So if you take a beat reporting class with us, not only are you working for us, you are also writing for Patch along with an editor at Patch, so you kind of get some professional work.
Okay. And what is Patch?
Patch.com is a hyperlocal site.
It's okay.
Throughout the nation. It's owned by AOL.
Ah, okay.
And they have different subdivisions, you know, Patch Glen Cove, Patch Ronkonkoma.
I see.
And each one of my students is assigned a location. They work with one of their editors.
Oh, cool.
I supervise it, and we go through revisions. Sometimes their patch editors don't always see their first work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I set up those kind of affiliations.
I see.
And then I also teach three courses every semester. I teach most of the writing classes, beat reporting, reporting one, feature writing. I teach producing the newscast, where we're actually making a weekly newscast that airs on our television station on campus called PTV.
Mm-hmm.
I teach an electronic journalism class. Mm-hmm. I teach some web classes. So really kind of an eclectic bunch of stuff.
Wow. Yeah, it sounds like it. It really covers the whole gamut of journalism courses, then, it sounds like, which is cool.
Yeah, it's fun.
Well, so I wanted to talk to you about this. I know that the research that you've been doing at Rutgers has to do with reporters' privilege and journalistic freedom and shield laws. And I wondered if you could just give us maybe a bit of an introduction about what you've written about. I know I've asked you about this a lot as we know each other. And I think this whole journalists going to jail to protect sources and, you know, sort of the seamy side of all of that is very interesting, I think.
I think with me, timing is everything because I entered the program in 2004.
Right.
And in 2004, the Valerie Plame investigation was just beginning.
Yeah.
Valerie Plame, if you don't recall, was a CIA operative who was undercover and was exposed through a Robert Novak column.
Right. She was married to
Joseph Wilson.
Right.
And he had written an editorial in the New York Times in 2003, I think July, kind of saying that he had done some investigations and that President Bush at that time had relied on information that was false to make assessments about whether or not Saddam Hussein was buying uranium in Niger.
That's right. I remember that. Mm-hmm.
And so when her name was exposed in the column, there was this huge investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was there were many journalists that were brought into this because they had either learned about it and not written about it or were about to write about it or had spoken about it.
Mm-hmm.
And an independent counsel, Patrick Fitzgerald, was appointed, and he started bringing journalists into court.
Right.
And some of the journalists had their media institution negotiate about exactly what they would expose and what they wouldn't. Mm-hmm. And they testified. And then we had Matt Cooper from Time Magazine at that time, mm-hmm. and Judith Miller, who was at the New York Times at that time, who did not want to expose their sources or give out information.
Right. And that turned into a whole big thing, I remember. Well, I want to talk a lot more about that. We're going to go to a break, and then we'll be right back on Speak Spin Radio.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Are you stuck in your business or career? Trying to take your business to the next level and it keeps hitting a wall? This is Sam Leibowitz, the Conscious Consultant. I will help you get to the root cause of your abundance issues and help move you forward in your life. Call me now and let's create the future you dream of. 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. The Conscious Consultant, helping conscious people be better business people.
Hi, this is psychic medium Betsy Cohen, host of the show The Power of Intuition. Join me at TalkingAlternative.com Mondays at 11 a.m. Call in for a free psychic reading. Learn how to tune into your intuition to feel better and to create your optimum life. I'm here to guide you and to assist you in creating the life that you deserve. Listen every Monday at 11 a.m. on TalkingAlternative.com.
Are you feeling overwhelmed in the current chaos of our changing times? A deeper understanding of authentic astrology can uncover solutions in every area of life. After all, metaphysics is just quantum physics, poetically expressed. I am Montgomery Taylor, and I offer lectures, seminars, and private consultations. For more information, contact me at Monty, M-O-N-T-Y, at rljmedia.com.
Talking Alternative Radio, 24 hours a day.
Hello and welcome back to Speak Spin Radio. I'm your host, Nancy Tatro, and we're here with Sandra Martenfeld, and we're talking about reporters' privilege and shield laws and journalistic freedom and things that I think we should all be at least mildly worried about, if not very. So, Sandra, we were just talking about, we raised Judith Miller as a topic.
Right.
And I think she's an interesting example of why this is such an important topic and about your research and what you found, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, I think she's kind of one of the linchpins of my research because mm-hmm. ultimately what my research shows is there's a lot of misinformation out there in the public about shield law. Shield laws and reporters' privilege. And some of it stems from how news media presents the images of reporters and also how they speak about reporters' privilege and shield laws in their editorial pages.
Okay.
At least that's what I looked at. I can't comment on news articles, but what my research looked at was three things. Mm-hmm. The first study is an interview study, which I'll talk about in a second, with various journalists about journalists who had gone to jail to protect their sources.
Right.
about whether or not their media institution supported them. Mm-hmm. How did going to jail changed how they practiced journalism?
Mm-hmm.
It's also talked about if any sources came forward to them. Mm-hmm. After they were released from jail, because they were deemed more trustworthy as journalists who were able to maintain certain ethical standards.
They would go to that mm-hmm. extent. Yeah, sure.
So it really looks at those narratives. And then the second portion of my study was a framing study from 1972 to 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And so I looked at the editorial pages of four newspapers, the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Chicago Times.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, the Chicago Tribune, mm-hmm. because I wanted to get a good geographic representation.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to see how these newspapers portrayed issues of reporters' privilege and shield laws on their editorial pages. What were they communicating to the public?
Mm.
And then my last portion of my study was three focus groups that talked to students, seniors, and baby boomers.
Hmm.
And it asked them what they knew about reporters' privilege and shield laws
mm-hmm.
and how likely they were to support those issues.
Right.
And it also showed them some editorials, had them read them, and ask them similar questions afterward to see if after they were educated a little bit, they've read some editorials,
mm-hmm.
whether their opinions had changed any.
Okay.
So that was the ultimate study. So how Judith Miller fits in is she was a case that was really written about tremendously
mm-hmm.
on the editorial pages. When you look throughout history about how many times a jailed reporter is written about on the editorial page. And when I say jail reporter, I've been speaking about someone who went to jail because they were either going to protect their sources, they didn't want to disclose them
mm-hmm.
in a court setting, or they did not want to disclose notes or video in a court setting.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time, if you look at how many times they've written about it in any of these newspapers that I mentioned, you'd get like from a handful to maybe half a dozen, maybe nine.
Hmm.
Judith Miller at one point, I think, was written about 66 times in the Washington Post alone.
Wow.
So you can see that this is the case that people really know about
mm-hmm.
and has become a representational mm-hmm. of the issues of shield laws and reporters' privilege.
Right.
And so the information that was conveyed during that time period has residual effects mm-hmm. on how people regard these issues.
Sure.
And you can't really, or you shouldn't really, think in terms of one case for an issue, because
right.
it's not. What happened with her was when they started the Valerie Plame investigation, there were two reporters who did not want to disclose their sources or information in court.
Mm-hmm.
One was Matthew Cooper, which I mentioned. He was with Time Magazine at that time.
Right.
Eventually, his notes were released to the special prosecutor by his publisher, Norman Perlstein, who thought that it was an appropriate thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Judith Miller did not want to reveal her sources. She was interesting because she had never written about the case. She actually supposedly only had notes, and the notes were labeled like Valerie Flame. It wasn't even the right name.
Mm.
And she just thought that, you know, a principle is a principle. And many of the jailed journalists I'd spoken with for my study actually kind of adhere to that. They really believe that, you know, here is a principle. We have a source. We've promised them confidentiality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. That's immutable.
Right.
And we're just not going to expose them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really, I think, where Judith Miller was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
I've never spoken to her, so I can't, you know, say exactly, but that's mm-hmm. my interpretation.
Right.
And so when she went to jail, and she went to jail in 2005 for 85 days,
mm-hmm.
The New York Times really was an intense supporter of hers.
She was writing for the Times right at the time.
She was writing for the Times.
And I seem to remember she was on the news a lot, too.
Mm-hmm.
She was everywhere for a while.
She was like the go-to cover girl of reporters' privilege for a while.
Right. And she was writing just, again, about weapons of It's the Middle East. She was considered an expert in that field, right?
Or, well, she had been part of the group that wrote about weapons of mass destruction.
Right.
Which they turned out, it turned out to be incorrect information.
Right.
So when she went to jail, she was always kind of... there was a mixed feelings about her. Mm-hmm. On one hand, there was many organizations supporting her, like a Society of Professional Journalists, for adhering to this kind of ethical standard at all costs, mm-hmm. and being willing to go to jail. And on the other hand, there was other people who were saying, well, you know, she's not the best representation for this case because of, you know, she had these inaccuracies in her reporting. She was known as kind of a loose cannon. Mm. There was all kinds of reasons people put out there.
Mm-hmm.
So she was an interesting case for this, but they really wrote about it quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
The New York Times, before she went to, when she was in jail, and before she went to jail, wrote over a dozen editorials supporting her.
I see.
Washington Post, as I said, mm-hmm. wrote about her continuously.
Right.
You know, she really was the most written about of all the jail journalists I studied.
Right. Raised a lot of consciousness and awareness. Of,
mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe we should stop just for a second to explain what is a shield law.
Mm-hmm.
And just say shield law.
Well, there's two things. There's a shield law, which is usually insinuated to be a federal shield law, which doesn't exist.
Okay.
And then there's state shield laws.
Mm-hmm.
Each state decides, you know, how much a journalist should be shielded,
so
to what extent.
By state, then. Each
it's
state
by
has
state
their
right
own.
Now. The problem is if you're called into a federal court, you don't have that protection of your state.
Ah.
And not all states have shield laws. There's 39 states, I believe, that have shield laws currently, plus Washington, D.C.
Okay.
And the shield laws kind of vary in what they cover. Some are very focused on professional journalistic institutions,
mm-hmm.
and others have support for more non-traditional journalists like bloggers.
Okay.
And so shield laws ideally will protect a journalist from having to go into court and expose a source after they've promised confidentiality.
Gotcha. Okay.
Or having to expose their notes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Well, we're going to go to another break, and we'll be right back with Sandra Martenfeld on SpeakSpin Radio.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Are you suffering from aches and pains? Has traditional medicine let you down? Are you tired of taking toxic medications? Then come to the Double Diamond Wellness Center and learn how our natural methods can help you to heal. Call us now at 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. Or find us on the web at www.doublediamondwellness.com. We look forward to serving you.
Is your marriage in trouble? Are you considering divorce? Hello, I'm Lawrence Bloom, a family law attorney in New York and New Jersey. No one is happier than the day their divorce is final. My firm can help you. We take the nasty out of the divorce process and make people happy. Please call us at 212-964-3502 for a free consultation. That's Lawrence H. Bloom at 212-964-3502. We make people happy.
Hey, all you crazy listeners. Looking to boost your business? Why not advertise on Talking Alternative with very reasonable rates? Interested? Simply email at info@talkingalternative.com.
Talking Alternative. Ya
Welcome back to Speak Spin Radio. I'm your host, Nancy Tatro, and we're talking to Sandra Martenfeld about reporter's privilege and shield laws. And you just explained to us, Sandra, about what shield laws are, and that they're just by state, and some states don't have them. And somebody like a Judith Miller or some of these other reporters you talk to could show up in court, and really, they don't have any or very little protection under the law then, right?
Well, it depends if it's on a state or federal level. Okay. On a federal level, you have no protection. Mm-hmm. On a state level, I said 39 states have some sort of shield law. Mm-hmm. But all the other states either have something in place, either through common law or some sort of statute, mm-hmm. that gives some protection to journalists.
Okay.
All the states except for Wyoming. Don't ask me why. They don't have anything.
Okay.
But when they have, you know, shield laws in place, that's because they respect, you know, this premise of reporter's privilege,
right.
that journalists to be able to get the information, that essential information you need to run an efficient democracy,
mm-hmm.
To really give as much information to the public as they can to participate in
right,
that activity,
right.
need to have a way of finding sources,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes have to promise confidentiality to a source to get the information.
Sure.
Now, that's always the exception. Normally, journalists want people to go on the record,
mm-hmm.
and they're really only going to promise confidentiality if the issue is important enough for the public good,
mm-hmm.
And they really can't get the information any other way.
Right.
I mean, that's what a good journalist does. Is you don't promise confidentiality to every Tom, Dick, and Harry.
Sure, sure. It's in an extreme case.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is the idea of the Fourth Estate, right?
Right.
That this is how...
They're the watchdogs.
Right, the watchdog. How you... The journalists, we rely on journalists to provide information to us that we can't get any
mm-hmm.
other way. So I know for your study, you spoke to a number of people other than Judith Miller, who went to jail to protect their sources.
Yes, right? I spoke with 8 journalists who had gone to jail to either protect their sources
mm-hmm.
or to prevent notes from being released in a courtroom setting.
Okay.
Because they, again, if you expose yourself in a courtroom setting, well, how can sources trust you later?
Right.
And that's kind of the idea behind this. And then I also spoke to a First Amendment scholar for some perspective, and Earl Caldwell. Earl Caldwell was a reporter at the New York Times who was involved in the pivotal Supreme Court case in 1972, Brandsburg v. Hayes, where it was very contested. Does this idea that the First Amendment protects reporters from divulging sources in courtroom situations or,
mm-hmm.
you know, giving out notes?
Right.
It was really voted at 5-4, so it was very tight. And the court case really says that reporter's privilege doesn't exist unless you look at an opinion written by Justice Powell. Justice Powell made an argument for qualified privilege. And since then, various lower courts have been using it, and First Amendment lawyers, to kind of have some wiggle room to show that privilege does exist.
Okay. Okay. Because it's usually a government that's asking for a source to be revealed.
Yeah, right? In the federal court cases, it's usually they are investigating something national security-wise or with Verily Plame, the exposure of CIA agents.
Right. It's so, the stakes are high.
The stakes are usually high.
So could you tell us a little bit about some of the reporters you spoke to?
Sure. I spoke to 8 people. I'll just quickly give you a little bit of a bio of some of these people that I spoke with.
Sure.
Lisa Abraham, who worked as a reporter for the Tribune Chronicle,
mm-hmm.
which was a small paper in Warren, Ohio. She was jailed for 22 days in 1994 because she refused to testify about an on-the-record interview before a state grand jury.
Uh-huh.
Bruce Anderson, who is the editor of the Anderson Valley Independent, a semi-weekly newspaper in California. He was jailed for 13 days in 1996 for not handing over a letter to the editor received from prison. Tim Cruz was an editor and publisher of the semi-weekly Sacramento Valley Mirror, which also covers California. He went to jail for 5 days in 2000 for not naming a source in a story about a theft charge leveled against a highway patrol officer. Brian Karam. He was a TV reporter for KMOL Television, which is an NBC affiliate in San Antonio, Texas. In 1990, he was subpoenaed to testify in a case about a police shooting. He refused to name the individuals who had arranged a jailhouse interview with the shooter, and Karam was jailed for 13 days. David Kidwell was a reporter for the Miami Herald. He refused to testify about an on-the-record interview he conducted in jail with a suspect in the death of a 7-year-old girl. He was sentenced to 70 days imprisonment. He served 14 of those, and that was in 1996. Shyla Kropf was jailed for 8 hours over the course of 2 days in 1991. Prosecutors wanted him to provide unpublished conversations with a state senator for a corruption trial. Jim Caracani, who was a reporter for WJAR-TV, an NBC affiliate in Providence, Rhode Island, he was sentenced to 6 months of house arrest in 2004 after he refused to divulge who provided him with a videotape showing a Providence official taking a bribe from the FBI. And then Josh Wolf, who was an independent blogger, journalist, videographer. He spent 225 days in jail, the longest of any reporter, and he refused to give unpublished video to a federal grand jury investigating a July 2005 demonstration of the G8 summit. And those were the 8 journalists I interviewed. And it was a very interesting conversations because those journalists you see kind of run the gamut of all the definitions of a journalist. We have people who were on established channels, big media institutions like NBC affiliates. We have a lot of kind of entrepreneurial, independent journalists who are kind of running their own publications to serve the public. And then we have some small town papers and some major papers. So you can see like this happens not just to the big guys or just the small guys, but to everybody.
And in most cases, did these people ultimately reveal their sources or were they able to hold their ground?
Most of them held their ground or negotiated. You know, Josh Wolf, for instance, said, well, I'll give you certain portions of things that were already published on my website. You know, some were jailed for a very long time.
So there must have been litigation going back and forth and arguments about, I guess, dealing, right? Trying to get pressure these people to reveal their sources.
And what was interesting, I think, to me is that many of them said that their media institutions supported them during this time period, both financially, emotionally. And then some of them kind of withdrew their support. You know, at one point, for instance, like David Kidwell got himself a pro bono lawyer because the Miami Herald said, you know, I think you've gone far enough.
So then generally the media outlets for whom these people worked were, you'd say, overall relatively supportive?
I would say half and half. Which is not great.
So then it's the reporter's personal ethics, really, that are driving the decisions that they make.
And some of these cases actually changed the like code of ethics of the media institution. For instance, in the case of Jim Taracani, they went back and they decided that if this had happened again, that they would only protect confidentiality up to a certain court case level. And that's what you had to tell your sources. We're not going to go to the Supreme Court with you. You know, we're going to go up just this high and then so it really kind of changed the source-reporter relationship a little bit.
And I'd love to get your opinion, too, on Julian Assange and the whole WikiLeaks thing, because it seemed like that also really changed. I mean, the whole WikiLeaks event or those events seem like they've raised awareness about the revealing of sources, the revealing of what's considered confidential information.
That really has kind of emphasized whistleblowers and the danger of a whistleblower giving information out for the public good or giving out information for a personal agenda. And I think with Julian Assange, you know, especially the First Amendment scholar I spoke with, this kind of feeling that to get a federal SHIELD law passed, you have to make a decision on how are we going to define what a journalist is. Mm. Who are we going to protect with this SHIELD law? Mm-hmm. And when you have someone like Julian Assange, it's hard to determine, is he a journalist or not? And if he is a journalist, that's like a whole wide net that we're giving protection to.
Right.
So many people say that, you know, Julian Assange has kind of thrown a wrench into this idea of a federal SHIELD law because to narrow down that definition is going to be difficult.
Right.
You know, on one hand, journalists don't want it too narrow because then a bunch of people might not get protection that deserve it, especially as technology changes and there is independent journalism going on and there's bloggers and all of that. You don't want it to be too tight. You don't want it just to say a professional journalist working, you know, 40 hours a week on this in this trade. But then you also want to be able to not give so much protection to people who are loose cannons.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah, that's a blurry line, isn't it?
Mm.
Okay, well, we're going to go to another break, and we'll be back in just a minute with Speak Spin Radio.
Talking Alternative Radio, 24 hours a day.
Hi, this is psychic medium Betsy Cohen, host of the show The Power of Intuition. Join me at talkingalternative.com Mondays at 11 a.m. Call in for a free psychic reading. Learn how to tune into your intuition to feel better and to create your optimum life. I'm here to guide you and to assist you in creating the life that you deserve. Listen every Monday at 11 a.m. on TalkingAlternative.com.
Hi, I'm Carol Ward from the Body Mind Wellness Program. Listen to my show for ideas and information to help you live a healthier life in body, mind, and spirit. You'll hear from terrific guests who are experts in the areas of health, wellness, and creativity. So join me every Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on TalkingAlternative.com. Professionals serving community.
Hi, this is Nancy Tatro from Speak Spin Radio. Speak Spin Radio is an exploration of the world of communication, how it happens and how to make it better, because the quality of your communication has a direct impact on the quality of your life. Tune in Mondays at 2 p.m. on TalkingAlternative.com, where I'll be interviewing experts from business, academia, the arts, and new thought. Join me Mondays at 2 p.m. and get all your communications questions answered on Speak Spin Radio.
This is Tony Martinetti, the aptly named host of Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Technology, fundraising, compliance, social media. Small and medium nonprofits have needs in all these areas. My guests are expert in all these areas and more. Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, Fridays, 1 to 2 Eastern on Talking Alternative Broadcasting.
TalkingAlternative.com.
Welcome back to Speak Spin Radio. I'm your host, Nancy Tatro. That was Lisa Brigantino on her CD, Wonder Wheel. And I'm here with Sandra Mardenfeld, and we're talking about reporter's privilege. And Sandra, of all these people that you spoke to who went to jail, what happened to them when they came out? Did their lives change? Did they... Were they, you know, did they get any special kudos or parades, cookies, balloons?
You would hope, but, you know, I think it's not like they became these poster people that everybody applauded all the time and said, oh, you know, you should go interview that person because they went to jail. I think for their sources, for the people who wanted to come forward with information that was delicate, many of the journalists indicated that people came forward easily, more easily, after they had come back from jail.
Okay.
And they were told by sources, you know, I'm coming to you because I know that you have ethics. I know that if you promise confidentiality, you mean it.
You really mean it, yeah.
And I think the most incredible story that was told to me was by David Kidwell. And he's now working out of Chicago. And at the Chicago Tribune, and he was investigating something. He was trying to get some information, and he was going through a tent city of the homeless because this was an area that was right by the area that he was trying to find information about. And he was passing out his card just kind of as a last-ditch attempt to get a source. And strangely enough, one of the people recognized his name. Oh, you're that journalist. You're the one who went to jail to protect your source. It's like, yes, I am. Didn't think anything of it until, you know, I think it was a week or 2 weeks later. You know, like two or three homeless men showed up at his building and said, I have some information for you. So, you know, that, I think, to me, shows you that people want to give out information, but I think they're afraid sometimes. And so if you have a reputation, like Kidwell did, that can be beneficial. And he's not the only one that mentioned that. There was a couple of other reporters that said that some sources have said to them, I'm coming forward to you because of these reasons. But some of the stories, I think, are not as positive, especially about how some journalists changed their practice of doing journalism after they went to jail.
What happened?
You know, for instance, Josh Wolf said, I'm more conscious of recording stuff that I wouldn't publish in the first place. I guess, which might be a good thing, but he doesn't want to be caught with extra information, you know, just in case somebody subpoenas him again. And then he's faced with the situation of losing credibility because he's giving footage off to, you know, courtrooms. Another journalist says, Shiloh Kropf says, there's some notes that he does not keep. You know, he says unless he's going to need the notes in the future, he kind of discards them after a few days. Now, he did that in part before he went to jail because of space limitations. But he also acknowledges that because of what happened to him, it's something more present in his mind. Earl Caldwell, who never went to jail but, you know, was subpoenaed, said that just the prospect of having to testify in court changed the nature of his work, and that the subpoena for his notes and information immediately took him off the story of covering the Black Panthers. And he said, it ended my relationship because I knew that I could no longer promise my sources anything. It was out of my hands. My word meant nothing. And so once the subpoena came, that ended my work on the story. So you can see that there really is a danger that if you subpoena journalists for information, that it might disturb or eliminate their research on a certain subject. A subject that's not going to reach the public by them.
Absolutely. So there are some pretty significant consequences to all of this.
There really is.
So I know you said in your study, Sandra, that you did, you as you mentioned, you did focus groups, you did a content analysis and the interviews.
Framing,
The framing, the framing study, which we haven't talked about much. But what did you find in your focus groups?
Well, the focus groups were interesting. I was doing the focus groups as kind of an informal way to get a sense of what the public knows about these issues. Now, I only conducted three focus groups, and focus groups are really not generalizable data, but they do kind of give you some indication about how that particular population or that group of people that you interviewed felt at the time that you questioned them. And what I found was that the student population and the baby boomers were really open to learning about shield laws and reporters' privilege. The student population didn't know anything about it. Mm. You know, one person thought shield laws were rape shield laws. And but they warmed to the topic very quickly. Mm. And when they heard the stories of the independent journalists especially, that really made them concerned about information not reaching them and about these kind of hunt for journalists and the unnecessary prosecution of them. That's kind of how they felt. Mm. The baby boomers, who knew more about it, had some misinformation about reporter's privilege. Mm. Most of them knew reporter's privilege and shield laws as Judith Miller. She was the sole representation of it. Mm-hmm. Both of those groups, after we had about an hour and a half conversation about shield laws and reporter's privilege, after they had read some editorials about it, after they looked at little paragraphs about various jail journalists, why they went to jail, how long, what they were fighting for, mentioned by the end of the focus group that this was an issue that they thought was extremely important, something that they were going to continue to seek information on, and indicated that they were really supportive of a federal shield law. And so I thought that was really interesting. But they also said that the stories that they had seen in the newspapers or on television or online never really conveyed the information in a way that was understandable.
Right.
They kind of either obfuscated the legal aspect or they didn't really represent the emotional appeal of it or the public good appeal of it. And the seniors showed that they were consistently against the media, mistrustful.
Oh, interesting.
The media was bad. And they also had a great deal of misinformation about reporters' privilege and shield laws, but they were not willing to listen. At least they did not indicate that this was an issue that they thought that the press deserved. They That's kind of felt that reporters' privilege was something that shouldn't be.
Wow.
That they did not deserve to protect confidential sources, that they should be like every other citizen, and if they were called into court, they had to expose the information.
Okay, so there were real generational differences then.
There really was.
Yeah. I think that's the fact that the students found this so interesting, I think, is meaningful when we talk about the need for media literacy. You know, people appreciating what journalism contributes to society and how we're so affected by what we learn and what we don't learn, you know, by the information that we get and that we don't get, and that all the information we get was probably, so much of it was edited.
Right.
Right. So not just the reporter, but the editor influences. I mean, you've been both a reporter and an editor, so you know how much power the editor has.
Sure. And also, I think with the way media is going these days, where so many organizations are downsizing, where entertainment journalism is something that people really clamor for rather than investigative journalism, where less people doing investigative journalism.
Right.
This is when I think shield laws and reporters' privilege become really important, because so few reporters are going after sometimes the stories that we need to hear.
Right, right, right. Okay, well, we're going to go to another short break, and we'll be right back on Speak Spin Radio.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Are you feeling overwhelmed in the current chaos of our changing times? A deeper understanding of authentic astrology can uncover solutions in every area of life. After all, metaphysics is just quantum physics, poetically expressed. I am Montgomery Taylor, and I offer lectures, seminars, and private consultations. For more information, contact me at Monty, M-O-N-T-Y, at rljmedia.com.
Are you stuck in your business or career? Trying to take your business to the next level and it keeps hitting a wall? This is Sam Leibowitz, the Conscious Consultant. I will help you get to the root cause of your abundance issues and help move you forward in your life. Call me now and let's create the future you dream of. 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. The Conscious Consultant, helping conscious people be better business people.
Hey, all you crazy listeners. Looking to boost your business? Why not advertise on Talking Alternative with very reasonable rates? Interested? Simply email at info@talkingalternative.com.
In the sea all the time, and if that's what it takes to be free, I don't mind. Still, still moving to me. Still moving to me.
And it's hard to explain how I feel.
Hello, and welcome back to Speak Spin Radio. I'm your host, Nancy Tatro, and I'm talking to Sandra Martenfeld about reporter's privilege and shield laws. And Sandra, in your study, you also did a framing study as a part of your research. And I think for the sake of all of our reference, our frame of reference, we just to know what framing is, a theory. It's an academic theory, right?
Right. So. It's also kind of like an operation, mm-hmm. like on how you're going to look at a data collection.
Right.
And so what I did was this something called constant comparative method, mm-hmm. which means that you look through hundreds of editorials. I actually looked through 472 editorials, mm-hmm. op-eds, and letters to the editor.
Mm-hmm.
And you read them multiple times to see what frames, and a frame is kind of like an overriding concept or focus.
Mm-hmm.
What is the main premise this board of editorial board, this news media institution,
right.
telling the public?
Right.
And so after reading it over and over, I came up with these four frames. And it was interesting to me because the more you read, the more these frames kind of cemented in place,
mm-hmm.
that they really fit in just into these four categories. And the frames were courts as adversary, mm-hmm. which means that the editorials or the letters of editor or the op-eds kind of portrayed a very contentious relationship between courts and the media.
Okay.
Journalists as heroes, you know, either, you know, look at these champions going to jail kind mm-hmm. of theme.
Mm-hmm.
The irresponsible journalist, mm-hmm. the journalist who doesn't do the right thing, and what I call the social good, which means that the frame really portrayed reporter's privilege or shield law as something for the betterment of mankind,
mm.
helping influence, you know, this marketplace of ideas and mm. feeding that.
Right.
And those four frames, I think, were interesting, but how the editorial sections used them wasn't always the optimal way. You know, for instance, they had a lot of confusing messages.
Mm-hmm.
So they would put together the journalist as hero frame with the irresponsible journalists in the same editorial op-ed or letter to the editor.
Oh, I see.
And now, of course, you can't control the letters to the editors. These are supposed to be what your readers think.
Right.
But you certainly can, like, look at what you're writing in an editorial or
Absolutely.
What your columnists are writing in an op-ed.
Sure.
And if there's a conflicting message, but there's no bridge between these two frames. There's mm-hmm. no explanation.
There's
why.
This, then there's that, or yeah, there's, something.
It's a confusing message.
Right.
And so I'm not talking about, you know, where these editorials, where they might have said, well, Judith Miller is a hero, she's going to jail, but she's not the best example.
Mm.
I'm talking about where they have these two mixed messages with no explanation.
Mm.
And there's dozens and dozens of these.
Hmm.
Or they'll do the irresponsible journalist with the public good. So yes, reporter's privilege is good for the public, but look, it's an irresponsible journalist. Why would you want to have that?
Mm-hmm.
And so you have these constant mixed messages. I also saw, and these were not frames, but more themes, there was a lot of opportunities that were lost to really explain the issue
mm-hmm.
and to make it more appealing, really, to the public.
Mm-hmm.
And they a lot of these were like legal things where they wouldn't explain legal language or mm-hmm. cases. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of omissions of information. Mm. Like I said, there was a lot of missing bridges.
Mm-hmm.
And so really what I gleaned from the editorial sections and what was kind of confirmed with the focus group is there were these opportunities to educate people about Shia laws and reporters' privilege mm-hmm. that just were not taken.
Right.
And some of the biggest offenders were regular columnists, where they would write about this case 6 or 7 or 8 times with all these different frames. And as a columnist, of course, your opinion might change, and right. that would be reflected in your column. But there was no communicating why there was this evolution.
Mm.
And I think that was problematic.
Sure. People don't know what's missing, so they don't right. have, they can't make an informed judgment about what they're reading. Right?
Yeah, and the thing about frames is very often frames happen unconsciously. They're right. work practices.
Right.
It's not like the columnist or the editorial board is thinking, oh, I'm going to perpetuate this frame.
I'm going to deliberately write right. from this perspective now.
Yeah. It just, you know, it happens. So what I think is beneficial for the news institutions to do is really kind of look back, how are you speaking about issues that are important to you journalistically?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're misinforming the public or you're confusing them, you're not doing anyone any good.
Right.
You could really promote something a little bit better. Not that, you know, journalism is supposed to be a balanced, not that you're, you know, grabbing a flag and going rah, rah,
mm-hmm.
but that you're giving it a fair perspective.
Yes.
And so I think one of the things I discussed in my dissertation was this idea of maybe educating student journalists a little bit more about framing
yeah.
and how it happens. So we're not quite as unconscious.
Yes.
Because usually when you teach framing to a student, you're teaching it in like a communications course
an
as part of theoretical framework.
Yeah.
You're not saying, here's your job practice and here's something that could affect your job practice.
Right. Okay. Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have today. So, I want to thank my guest, Sandra Martenfeld, for coming on the show today. Thanks so much for your time and your thoughts, Sandra. It was really interesting.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
I think this is such an important topic. It's something that we all really need to know a little more about. If we are interested in getting in touch with you or learning more about you, how can we?
Oh, I have a website you can contact me from. Okay. It's www.sandramartenfeld.com, SandraMartenfeld.com.
Okay, great. And you still offer your freelance writing and editing services too, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, she does. Okay. And I invite you all to go to my website at speakspin.com to learn about my services and my coaching programs. If you need help preparing for an interview or a meeting or a tough conversation, or if you're ready to make a significant change in your life, I'm here to help you. Please contact me at nancy@speakspin.com and let me know what's going on. So that's it for today. Thanks again to my guest, Sandra Martenfeld, and our sponsors, Compass Strategies and also Aspire Athletic Coaching, for their support, and all of you for tuning in. And remember, say who you are, because there is no one else like you. Beautiful, powerful, wonderful you. Take care.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
How's your game? Want to improve your performance, focus, and motivation? Then you need Aspire Athletic Consulting. Stop second-guessing yourself. Move your game to the next level. Bring back the fun of the sport. Help your child build confidence and self-esteem through sports. Contact Dale at Aspire Athletic Consulting for a free 15-minute power session to get unstuck today. Your greatest athletic performance is just a phone call away at 801-604-0294 or visit aspireconsulting.vpweb. Motivational coaching for athletic excellence. Aspire to greatness.
Are you suffering from aches and pains? Has traditional medicine let you down? Are you tired of taking toxic medications? Then come to the Double Diamond Wellness Center and learn how our natural methods can help you to heal. Call us now at 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. Or find us on the web at www.doublediamondwellness.com. We look forward to serving you.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network at www.talkingalternative.com. Now, broadcasting 24 hours a day. Talking Alternative.
Looking to meet Mr. or Mrs. Right, but still haven't found the one? Want to make your current relationship as fulfilling as possible? Then tune in on Thursdays at 1 p.m. for Love in the Afternoon with Marnie Gallison. As a professional matchmaker, I've seen it all. With distinguished authors, industry gurus, and experts on everything from wine to fashion, join us as we discuss dating, relationships, and more on TalkingAlternative.com.
Are you fed up with talking points rhetoric? Every way you turn, it's left or right spin, ideology, no reality. In fact, it's ideology over intellect. No more. It's time for the truth. Join me, Larry Sharp, a.k.a. The Neo-Sage, Tuesday nights, 9 to 11 Eastern, for the Ivory Tower radio program. In the Ivory Tower, we'll discuss what's important to you, society, politics, business, and family. It's provocative talk for the realist and the skeptic who want to know what's really going on, what does it mean, and what can be done about it. So gain special access to the Ivory Tower and listen to me, Larry Sharp, your Neo-Sage, Tuesday nights, 9 to 11 New York time. Go to ivorytowerradio.com for details. That's ivorytowerradio.com. The Ivory Tower is a great place to visit for both entertainment and education. Listen in, Tuesday nights, 9 to 11. It will make you smarter.
TalkingAlternative.com.